Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller lists, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
Hi, I'm Clay Smith. I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews.
And I'm editor-at-large Megan Labrice.
And today, we are talking to a writer you probably have not heard of. Her name is Julia Phillips. And you may not have heard of her because she's a debut writer. She's got a novel has generated a lot of excitement. It's titled Disappearing Earth, and it's set in the far northeastern corner of Russia, the Kamchatka Peninsula. And it is both a kind of literary fiction novel. It's also a mystery. It's really well done. We gave it a starred review. And it begins with a tragic crime, right, Megan?
Indeed it does. This novel by an author you may not have heard of, about a place you may not have heard of, but you're going to be hearing a lot more about both soon, begins on an August afternoon in the city at the tip of the peninsula when two sisters, ages 8 and 11, are down by the water, and they encounter a strange man who beseeches them to assist him to his car. He says he's injured, and he says he will take them home. And they get in the car, and they disappear.
And this is all in the first chapter.
Right. And very interestingly, we don't hear anything else about that for the next 240 pages.
Yeah. The case is resolved, we should say. She doesn't leave you hanging. But it's just, if you're looking at this book as a mystery, it's got a real intriguing structure because, you know, people who like mysteries expect to get clues, you know, parceled out every so often. And you do get clues and sort of connections, and you start realizing how things may have happened. But she's doing it at her own pace, and I respect that.
Month by month, each chapter is a month, are these encapsulated stories of other women and girls who live on this peninsula. And each chapter contends with how they are affected by the two girls' disappearance. And it's a really broad spectrum. You know, there are some who, you know, just hear about this story on the news. And there are some who were quite close to the girls.
Yeah. It's just really well done. And most of us who read the novel will be reading about a totally new place, kind of remote, beautiful corner of Russia. And really intrigued by the crime also. So it's her debut book, as we said. So why don't we call her up and see what she has to say?
Can't wait.
I know that you spent time in the remote, you know, sort of peninsula of Russia that you write about in this novel. It's relatively close to Japan and to Alaska. But take us back to the moment when you first thought about this story and that it might make a good novel.
Absolutely. I studied Russian as a teenager and as a college student. And all that time I wanted to become a novelist, but I had this really active interest in Russia. I'd studied in Moscow for a semester and studied the language for some years. And so what I knew from the start is that I wanted to write a novel set in Russia, somewhere in Russia. And I didn't know where, but I had these certain ideas about what I wanted that setting to be. I wanted it to be, not a huge city like Moscow. I wanted it to be someplace with more connections to nature and also someplace maybe a little more contained, or not an enormous sprawling city, but someplace that had more of its own kind of regional identity. Mm-hmm. And when I learned about Kamchatka, it just seemed like the perfect, perfect place to set a book. I didn't know yet what that book would be, mm-hmm. but I knew that whatever I wanted to write, this is where I wanted to write it. So I went to Kamchatka, and once I got there, it seemed like, and I think this is probably a reflection of, I was there alone in a setting that was, you know, a context that was really new to me and unusual to me. And I think I was probably feeling a little scared and a little lost, and it just started to seem like this is a place a person can really disappear. You can go off the grid and no one would know where you were. Mm-hmm. And I think that's how the story came to be. I kind of kept digging into that feeling and that experience.
Yeah. And it's so interesting. This was really my introduction to Kamchatka, located in the Russian Far East, isolated by water and mountains. Your descriptions are absolutely gorgeous, very evocative. This is not a place that was always easily reached by tourists such as yourself, correct?
Absolutely. In fact, I would say it's certainly been more challenging to reach in the past, but it's still pretty difficult to reach. So
what did it take?
It is 16 time zones away from New York, where I live. So you fly 11 hours to Moscow, and then you fly another 9 hours to Kamchatka, because it doesn't have any road connections. It doesn't have any roads or railroads or anything that go to the peninsula. So you have to reach it by sea or by air, which was very challenging, but it relatively, you know, was very easy, because until 1991, all through the Soviet Union, Russia was where the Pacific naval fleet of the Soviet, you know, Navy was headquartered. And so no foreigners were allowed to go to the peninsula at all. And even Russians needed special government permission to go there. They had usually to be military affiliated or to know someone there who would invite them. So to be able to go to Kamchatka and live there and travel there and research there was a huge privilege, because until recently it wouldn't have been possible for me at all.
And so just tell us, I mean, how specifically Kamchatka? Like what led you specifically there?
I a lot of it in the very start was I was researching different regions of Russia. I knew I wanted to go there to write. I went there on a fellowship, on a writing fellowship. So I was funded for a year, but I had to, because of that, I had to, you know, in my applications, make a compelling case for why this place. Mm. So I was looking for what place I could make a compelling case for. And yep. When I saw really the Google image results of Kamchatka, I fell in love with it. It's one of the most beautiful places in the whole world. It's a volcanic peninsula. It's on the Pacific Ring of Fire. Because a lot of it was sheltered by the military and remains protected by the national park system. About 15% of the territory on the peninsula is protected from development in any way. Mm. It is spectacularly beautiful. And I think from the start, you know, that was the first kind of attraction, I would say. I looked at it and I thought, that's a place I want to go to. That's a place I want to live. Now I'll find any reason to go to. And in fact, when I started to educate myself about it, there were a lot of really, really good reasons to go there. Mm-hmm. The fact that it is so isolated, so enormous, so much of its population, its infrastructure are concentrated in one city. Mm-hmm. So Kamchatka is about the size of California, but about half its population, a little bit more than half, lives in one city that's really the size of St. Louis. Mm-hmm. So that extreme, you know, kind of cultural setup where most of it, there's this huge urban-rural divide. There's this huge kind of, it's a land of political extremes. Yeah. I would say it is in many ways a microcosm of the entire country, because it represents this shift from kind of Soviet isolationism to contemporary Russian desire for global participation, or, you know, globalization, foreign investment, et cetera. It's a lot of kind of epitomizes a lot of these larger trends around Russia and the U.S. in a way that seemed very compelling and also very attractive.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this story, Disappearing Earth, begins in that St. Louis-sized city. And I was wondering if you could just sketch out, for the benefit of our listeners, a little bit of what happens in August, the book's opening chapter.
Of course. So when the book opens, we meet these two sisters who are at the city center in this capital city. And they're 8 and 11 years old. It is, you know, they're on summer vacation. It's August. And they're hanging out there and they meet a man who is injured. He sprained his ankle and they help him back to his car and he offers them a ride home. And when they get in that car, it turns out he doesn't take them home. And that, what happens then kicks off the rest of the book, where they go in that car once that chapter ends. That's what our question is for the rest of the book, and that's what everyone else is trying to figure out.
So let's talk about that structure a little bit, because it's really intriguing to me. I mean, I guess we could talk about this book as a, you know, as literary fiction, but it's also a mystery. You know, we read about the abduction of the two sisters in the first chapter, as you said, you know, but we don't really learn that much more about the case or the sisters until much later in the novel. But that's not really how a mystery is supposed to go, right?
I mean, I can't disagree with that. I think you're both right.
But
it's a nice
but structure. What we learn in increasingly, like from Pebble up all the way up to Boulder, are little nuggets of information of how the girl's disappearance affects the lives of other people who are living on this peninsula. Also, just a side note, this strikes me as a notably terrestrial book. There's a lot of gravel and sediment and rocks and pebbles all the way up to volcanoes. And that does make me want to ask you, why did you title it Disappearing Earth?
That's so funny. I always feel like there's a lot of water in this
really?
Book. Water fire. So I'm really glad actually to hear you speak about their elements. It makes me feel much better. When we meet those sisters in the first chapter, one is telling the other a story about a tsunami that hit Kamchatka. She's telling her kind of an urban legend about the tsunami that swept this town away off Kamchatka, but it's based on a real tsunami that hit Kamchatka in 1952. That is not as large or as enormously sweeping as it is in this 11-year-old's telling, but really was quite catastrophic. I think those natural threats and the kind of specter of loss that is always present on Kamchatka is what the title speaks to, or what I wanted it to speak to, that these, you know, these girls, a few pages after telling the story of the tsunami, where this piece of earth is swept away by a wave, they are also swept away by these forces out of their control. And all these other women in their community are really afraid too. They don't trust the ground under their feet. They feel unsteady. They don't know what they'll lose next. And they experience a range of loss and they don't know what'll happen. And this community as a whole is reeling from the literal loss of their nation only, you know, less than three decades earlier. Mm-hmm. Their whole country and political structure collapsed and now they're trying to rebuild out of that. And it's difficult. So to me, the title, I hope that the title speaks to that fear of what has been lost and what might be lost next, and also their desire as a community to figure out in the face of loss how to connect to each other and keep going. And that, thinking about the structure, you asked about the structure before. Yeah. I wanted to me... I really, speaking of podcasts, there's this great podcast called In the Dark. Mm. That's I couldn't recommend it more highly. And it's the first season is about a crime about a boy that disappeared in the late 80s, I want to say, in Minnesota. And then the second season is about a court case. But it takes those individual experiences and it connects them to a whole system. It puts them in this huge context where you understand, like, what are the failings of, for example, the authorities who knew that this was happening, who saw that this was happening and didn't stop it, who had information that was never kind of collected or properly put together. Or to me, that's the most compelling way to connect to a story of violence or loss, which are the stories that really compel me, to understand them not as just kind of unusual. The incident that kicks off this book, Abduction of Children by a Stranger, is unbelievably unusual. really, really very, very rare. But the experiences of violence and loss and pain by the other characters in the book that are connected more or less to these girls, you know, connected to them to different degrees, those are really common. And they're neither the unusual thing or the common thing that, you know, an abusive relationship or a doctor's appointment gone wrong. Those don't occur totally isolated from each other. They're on a spectrum of violence and a spectrum of harm. And they relate to each other in some way, and they relate to how all the people in that community respond to the violence around them that is more high profile. Mm-hmm. And they relate to how authorities respond to that violence. Yeah. And I really want the book to convey that sense of interconnection and help us understand how such spectacular rare event can happen.
Yeah. Well, and it is a traditional mystery in the sense that, as sort of Megan was, you know, saying, I mean, little clues and connections are sort of leaked, I guess, by you throughout the course of the story. But there are also, you know, a vast number of pages where there aren't any clues. And that allows you to really write about this totally unique place. And so I love that you keep people guessing, but you're after another story as well, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I just, that was really well done.
I appreciate
no question
that.
That
makes
there,
me I happy. I like it. I like it with no question there.
Yeah.
Makes me really happy.
So let me ask you about this sort of, I don't know if we'd call it an interregnum or what, but this moment, this sort of historical moment in Russia that you're writing about, sort of after the end of Soviet life, and then what came after. I don't know if glasnost is really the right term, but at one point in the novel, you're writing about a character named Revmira, if I pronounce that correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And you write, quote, "Revmira's parents had raised her in a strong home, an idyllic village, a principled people, a living Evan culture."
Oh, Evan culture, yeah.
Evan culture, a socialist nation of great achievement. That nation collapsed. Nothing was left in the place it had occupied, end quote. And, you know, as I was sort of saying, I mean, your characters do seem a little stuck or something between Soviet life and what came after. Tell us a little bit about why that period in Russian life is interesting to you.
It's extremely interesting to me, and it's a good question. I wonder if I can get to the bottom of why it's interesting to me. I think a lot of this book was... Mm-hmm. me trying to write into understanding why it's so interesting to me. I'm betraying my age here, but I I was born at the very end of the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union is a place that I, as someone who studied Russian and studied in Russia and am really interested in Russia, will never get to go. I'll never see that country, and I'll never know. You know, I'm never going to meet a citizen of the Soviet Union. I'll meet people who were, but everyone there has lost that place. Mm-hmm. to, you know, some people's happiness and some people's regret. And so all the Russia I know is post-Soviet Russia, and people have, you know, it's different in different places, but in Kamchatka particularly, Kamchatka was very, some people on Kamchatka benefited an enormous amount from Soviet times. It was, the peninsula was important militarily. It was important politically. It was very, very well funded. It was built up, and a lot of that was lost after the fall of the Soviet Union. And nothing, I mean, like Revmira said, like nothing has come in to take its place. And so there's a lot of looking backwards, and there's a lot of sorrow for that, because what was lost was not only money and politicians or a system of rule, but also a belief system, a kind of national identity and faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that people, again, I would hate to portray the Soviet Union as a beautiful and flawless experience. But to lose your national identity even a really complicated national identity is extraordinarily painful.
Yeah.
And it takes more than a year, or more than 10 years, or more than 20 years to find your footing again, especially in such a relatively young country as the Russian, you know, the contemporary Russian Federation is.
Yeah. It's so interesting because, you know, last week I was telling you, I mean, Megan and I talked to John Burnham Schwartz, who mm-hmm. has this novel, The Red Daughter, which is about, he sort of fictionalizes the life of Svetlana, Stalin's daughter, and who, of course, was a very famous defection mm-hmm. to the United States. And there are moments in that novel, right, Megan, where there's this sort of odd nostalgia for the Soviet Union. And it's so jarring for an American reader, because we always thought that is the worst place you could possibly grow up.
Right. And in fact, she returned for a couple of years, too.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember my first year, I lived on Kamchatka for a year and then a summer a few years later. And that year I was there was one that overlapped with Occupy Wall Street, which was really exciting to me. As an American watching my home from far away, I really was sorry that I wasn't there. I wanted to be, you know, it just felt like there was so much momentum and people were taking to the streets and it just seemed like anything was possible. And I remember saying to a friend on Kamchatka, it feels like there's going to be a revolution. I'm so excited. And he said, "Have you ever lived through a revolution?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, I have." And he said, you don't, he said, revolution, people starved to death. We didn't have heat here. People froze to death. You don't want a revolution. I don't know if it's hard for Americans to understand. It's certainly hard for me, you know, this American, to understand that loss and that instability and the nostalgia for something that, as complicated as it was, you could believe that it was going to be there the next day. You believed that it was going to, you know, it's your country. You believe it's going to stay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I was reading Secondhand Time by Svetlana Alexeyevich while I was in edits on this, thanks to my very...
Really?
Yeah, it was my very, very brilliant editor was like, read all these books, which was one of the, I mean, I was going to say it's one of the best experiences of editing, but actually every single bit of it was fantastic. And reading that, you know, the way she creates this polyphonic narrative, but if there's so much of that voice of Rev Mira is so many people are saying, looking back to what they've lost with the fall of the Soviet Union in that book, it's really almost too much to bear how painful it is.
Yeah, there are many losses, great and small, in this book. And I feel like this is probably like three questions late or three comments late. But speaking of Rev Mira and going all the way back to the premise, there are not only two missing girls in this book. There is a third missing girl in this book, and she is a member of Rev Mira's family. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about her.
Yeah. So she is the person, I know, I trust that you'll edit this out if this is too spoilery, but she is the person that I'm trying to think.
Well, one thing I think we could talk about in regards to this is a very ethnically diverse peninsula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the case of the disappearance of this girl, of this young woman, the case is treated very differently by the media and police than the case of the two missing sisters.
Yes.
Why is that?
Lots of reasons, I think. Certainly one of race and ethnicity. The sisters who go missing are ethnic Russians, and this other girl is Aven. She is part of this indigenous group on Kamchatka. She is older than they are.
Right.
And people see her differently because of that. They see her as less innocent or more party to her own harm. Whereas the younger girls are seen as, you know, very much presented as perfect victims. The younger girls are also, they live in a city and they're better connected. Their mother's a journalist. And the girl who had disappeared earlier is you know, she lives in a village and her mom is well connected in that village, but they don't have the kind of sway that the Russian girl's family does. It was really thinking about how I approached this book, thinking about this book as the story of a community and the understanding of the impact of an individual crime as it relates to a system, a system of failures, a system of oversights. It is very important to me and was really important to me in the writing of this to look hard at how gender and ethnicity and race and age influence how we react to or give attention to or withhold attention from or perpetuate how people are hurt around us.
Yeah. And to that, I would add sexuality.
Absolutely.
In this book.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all, I mean, there's no separating any of it from any of it, you know, it's like,
yeah,
the ways in which that third character, who is not the sisters, is overlooked.
Yeah.
It is not just one way that she's overlooked, or not one way that her case is neglected. And it's many, many ways that overlap with each other.
Yeah. So, a lot of excitement for this novel. We, for example, gave it our reviewer and fiction editor gave it a starred review. What do you think you'll write about Russia again? Maybe you already are. I don't know. I'm not sure.
It's interesting. While I was working on this book, I thought Kamchatka in particular and Russia, of course, like I've loved Russia since I was a kid and wanted to study it and fell in love with Kamchatka when I was 21. All I wanted to do was be there. All I wanted to do was write about it. It felt like this fever. And yet my relation to it has changed through the writing of this book, where it feels like I got to give a lot of time and brain space into exploring it. And in some way that feels like it's come to a natural kind of, like a peaceful end. I also think my relationship, the way I think about Russia has changed after the 2016 election. I think that was extremely illuminating. And we continue to be illuminated on that front. And it made me think more critically and with, I hope, less biased eyes about what Russia has meant to me in my life and what its influence has meant in my life and how to kind of negotiate that going forward, both kind of personally and creatively and politically and as a, you know, as an American. It's been very, very interesting.
Yeah. Well, whatever comes next, we'll look forward to it. The new novel is titled Disappearing Earth. We've been talking to Julia Phillips. And Disappearing Earth is out today. So we encourage you to go and get it. Thanks for your time, Julia.
Thank you so much.
You know, it is so interesting how this is a literary novel. It's also a mystery. I don't know. I guess book critics like us are always trying to figure out what kind of a category a book fits in. But it's so nice to find a book that, you know, you don't feel like you have to categorize. I mean, it does several things at once, you know?
Exactly. I'm not even sure I would call it a novel. They do. It says novel on the cover, but it's like a short story cycle, too.
Yeah.
And it's extremely successful.
Yeah, because each chapter is about different people, and you're learning more and more about Kamchatka and the people there. It's just really well done.
It's like a delicious box of chocolates. It's like each chapter is its own perfect morsel.
Yeah. No, I agree. So as I said, that one is out today, May 21st. There are some other good books out this week. We're heading into summer, so let's call up our senior editors after the break to see what else they think you might want to consider reading.
Let's do it.
You're listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. the ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
All right, welcome back. We've got our senior editors on the line. We've got Vicki Smith. She covers children's books for us. Laura Simeon is our young adult book editor. Eric Liebetrau is our nonfiction editor. And Laurie Muchnick covers fiction for us. So, Vicki, let's start with children's books. What are you excited about this week?
I am excited about Harold and Hog Pretend for Real, which is one of the Elephant and Piggy read books. No, sorry. It's Elephant and Piggy Like Reading. And people who have been familiar with children's books for a while probably know the Elephant and Piggy Early Reader books by Mo Willems. And Elephant and Piggy have more or less walked off the stage, but they have become sort of the introducers of a whole new line of early readers that are being written and illustrated by people other than Mo Willems. And this one is by Dan Santat. And it is about an elephant named Harold and a pig named Hog. And readers who know Elephant and Piggy will immediately detect that there is a play being made on the familiar characters. And what Harold and Hog decide to do is pretend that they are Elephant and Piggy. And so Harold puts on a pair of wire-rimmed glasses so that he looks like Gerald, and Hog puts on a sort of paper snout so that he looks like Piggy. What readers are observing is that Dan Santat's modeling the two characters is very realistic. You know, there's a whole lot more depth to them than the very flat cartoon style of Mo Willems. And so it all looks very funny. But what is even more funny as the story gets going is that it's really clear that Harold is absolutely nothing like Gerald and Hog is absolutely nothing but like Piggy. But they're perfect opposites. And so after really coming to this existential crisis that they can't pretend to be Elephant and Piggy because they are too unlike them, they just swap accessories so that Harold pretends to be Piggy and Hog pretends to be Gerald, and they have a wonderful time. It's this fabulous metafictive look at pretend play and how characters are built, and this really lovely accepting affirmation that different personalities can play well together and that complement each other beautifully. It's so super sweet and very funny.
Vicki, I was thinking about how people often underestimate these beginning readers, but there's so much complexity and there's so much sort of deliberate thought put into making them developmentally appropriate and just so many layers to them. And I love it.
There is absolutely nothing easy about learning how to read. And so to have people put so much effort into this incredibly important moment in every reading child's development, it's really lovely to see. You know, Mo Willems has been fabulous. It's really great to see him sort of spreading that, you know, spreading his success and bringing in other people and really working hard to make sure that everybody understands how important early readers are. It's great.
So, Laura, stick with us. What's happening in YA?
Well, this week there's a new book out from Ariel Kaplan. It's her third book, also her third Kirkus Star. So she's on a roll. Yeah. And before I talk about this book, I just wanted to say in general, what I love about her is she really gets teens today and what their real concerns are. You know, her last book, We Regret to Inform You, was all about the kind of arms race that is the college application process. And she writes, like, she just excels in the voice of her characters. The characters she writes, they're smart. You know, the dialogue is clever, but it never gets kind of self-conscious or excessively mannered, which can be a pitfall that sometimes these books can fall into. But anyway, this new one is called We Are the Perfect Girl. And somewhat like the last book, it's about two best friends who are total opposites. So you have Afra, who is kind of, she's very confident, she's outgoing, she's witty, She's also not conventionally pretty, and she's aware of that. She says, I have never myself sat down and cataloged my many imperfections, but if you are a girl person and you live in the world, people feel compelled to let you know this stuff. So she doesn't have illusions about, you know, how people see her physical self. Meanwhile, her best friend, Bethany, is very quiet and very shy and also very conventionally beautiful. Meantime, they have a crush on the same boy, and this story is kind of a twist on Cyrano de Bergerac, and her first book, Grendel's Guide to Love and War, was inspired by Beowulf, so that's another commonality. But this is updated Cyrano, an app is involved, and it's really a commentary on lookism and the impact on girls and women of so much emphasis on appearance. So Afra, for example, her older sister, she and her older sister used to look very much alike until her older sister saved up $4,000 and had a nose job before she went off to college. And Afra feels very betrayed by this. You know, it's like that was their nose, the family nose, and she liked her nose. Anyway, so it's a great book.
Talking about body image, I'm going to recommend a book that's an adult book that's a bit heavier, but it deals with a lot of the same things. And that's Hunger by Roxane Gay from a couple years ago. Mm. It's actually a pretty heartbreaking book. It covers a lot of other things, but one of the main things is that she says at the beginning, she says, I'm not sure there's no real powerful insight into what it takes to overcome unruly body and unruly appetites. And I think she actually does a good job of doing just that. And so I think it's, if people have interest in that kind of, you know, struggling with body image, then this is a really good memoir to check out.
Okay, thanks. I'll look for it.
So, Eric, what's going on in nonfiction?
Nonfiction, I'd like to talk about the latest memoir from Ruth Reichel, the food writer. It's called Save Me the Plums. She had a memoir come out a few years ago called My Kitchen Year. But this one it's about her journey through the food world, working at the L.A. Times and the New York Times. But most of it covers her time at Gourmet during the last decade, which unfortunately they had to close that publication. But this is a really good, fun, kind of gossipy, excellent, you know, really well-written memoir for any kind of foodie or people who have an interest on how, you know, what goes behind the scenes on restaurant reviewing especially. And she does some really good snapshots of some of the big wigs at Condé Nast, including the publishers, Cy Newhouse. And it's just, she also includes a couple articles or a couple stories about some big articles in the food world that have come out in the past decade or so, specifically David Foster Wallace's Consider the Lobster, which anyone who's into food and hasn't read that should read it immediately. Yeah. Maybe after reading this book.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read this book because I think I've read all of Ruth Reichel's memoirs. She's written, maybe this is her fourth by now?
Right.
But the one that I really, really liked was Garlic and Sapphires, which was about being the restaurant critic at the New York Times. So, I mean, maybe it's just because I'm really interested in the media as well as food, but she's so good at the kind of, not just like, you know, how the recipe for how to make food, but the recipe for how to make journalism. She's really good at that.
And, yeah, that's a great, you're
so
right.
So I'm looking.
Good point. It's a good, the intersection of food and media, you know, she's kind of at the top of that.
Yeah.
She deconstructs it really well.
So, Laurie, what are you liking in fiction?
I am liking a book called Rules for Visiting by Jessica Frances Cain, which is a really charming contemplative novel about a woman named May who is she's approaching her 40th birthday. She lives with her father in her sort of Midwestern hometown, which is a college town. She's the gardener at the college. And, you know, she has a sort of happy, uneventful life. And then something happens, which is that a poet who is a teacher at the college, wins a $50,000 prize for writing a poem about a yew tree that May had planted at the college, having gotten a clipping, a cutting from a yew tree in Scotland that's estimated to be 3,000 to 5,000 years old. And so she cultivated this yew tree, and a poet, you know, poet won $50,000. So the college decided to give her a reward for this. So they gave her, I think, a month off work. And, you know, her, you know, this is like the biggest change that's happened in her life in years. And she decides to go around and visit some of her old friends who she hasn't kept in touch with. And she doesn't have a lot of friends. She's very self-contained. And she decides that what she's going to do with this extra time is she's going to go visit her college roommate and different friends in different cities. And you see her sort of slotting herself into their households and their lives and rebuilding her relationships, and the way, you know, what she learns about herself that she brings home. And, you know, unsurprisingly, because it's a novel, you know, her life has changed by the end of it. And it's just very a sweet contemplative book.
Lori, I was really interested in reading the review that this book is illustrated, and most grown-up novels are not illustrated. So I wanted to find out, you know, what's the effect of the illustrations? I mean, it doesn't look like they're narrative illustrations, but how wonderful is it to see an adult book that's got illustrations in it?
It's, you know, it's fantastic. And it's actually, it's illustrated by Edward Carey, who's a novelist, who's also written, he's written adult novels and he's written YA novels.
Oh, he has written some of the weirdest, coolest kids horror ever.
Yeah, I can't remember the names of the books, but yes, he writes in this very sort of precise, I don't know if he actually is drawing in pencil, but it just looks like, you know, he's just drawing beautiful pictures of trees. And it's just like, you know, it's not like a picture book. It's just, you know, there'll be a page with a different tree at the beginning of every chapter. And it, you know, just brings me back to sort of childhood reading a Nancy Drew book or something that would have an illustration from what was going to happen in that chapter at the beginning of it. And yeah, it's, I loved that part of it.
Thank you all. We hope you join us next week. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.